It's now my pleasure to introduce Penn State Vice Provost, Dr. Blanny Bone.
Good afternoon. Here in central Pennsylvania, we're seeing more and more reports of undercover investigations, arrests for alleged drug dealers, and various drug-related crimes. Today's speaker has confronted the drug problem on a much larger scale than what we have here in central Pennsylvania. Since 2003, Karen Tandy has served as the administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration, or the DEA, which is an agency of the U.S. Department of Justice. The DEA partners with various law enforcement agencies worldwide. Just this year, the DEA announced the seizure of 20 tons of cocaine from a ship just off the coast of Panama. In another operation, $207 million in drug money was seized in Mexico City. DEA has an annual budget of more than $2 billion and approximately 11,000 employees across the U.S. and in 85 foreign offices. Under Ms. Tandy's leadership, DEA investigations resulted in three big points. One, criminal charges against 87% of the most wanted drug trafficking leaders. Two, an 82% increase in the number of dismantled priority drug trafficking organizations. And three, a 400% increase in the seizure of drug proceeds and related assets. She expanded the DEA's international presence by entering the first intelligence agreements with both China and Russia, and also by sending the first teams of DEA agents to Afghanistan. Before becoming DEA administrator, Ms. Tandy was Associate Deputy Attorney General and Director of the Organized Crime Enforcement Task Forces. She was responsible for developing national drug enforcement policy and strategies. Ms. Tandy is a Texan via Fort Worth and a graduate of Texas Tech and also its law school. Among her many awards and commendations, she received the Attorney General's Award for Distinguished Service and the Department of Justice Award for Extraordinary Achievement. Ms. Tandy announced last month that she was leaving the DEA in a life of more than 30 years of public service, and she's joined the corporate world. As a matter of fact, today is her first day in the corporate world. She just became, today is the first day, as the Senior Vice President of Motorola's Global Governmental Relations and Public Policy Division, and she will lead Motorola's vast global initiatives. Please join me in welcoming outgoing DEA Administrator Karen Tandy to the Penn State Forum.
Hi, good afternoon. Great to be with you, Blanny. Thank you so much for having me. I am most importantly a Penn State mom and my husband a Penn State dad. We have a sophomore in college here, and we were last here for our first tailgating party in this room that was phenomenal, which was the Purdue game, which, of course, we prevailed. So it was a great day all the way around. Let me just actually roll the clock back for just a second. When I went to bed last night, I was the DEA administrator. When I woke up this morning, I was the senior vice president of Motorola. I am not obviously going to see Motorola today, so I'm still in that DEA mode and courtesy of Motorola today. The immediate adjustment was there was no one to open my car door. There was no one in my driveway to take me to a destination that I didn't need to know where it was. And I complained that my driver is now an aging protection detail person. That would be my husband. Anyway, I am so delighted to be with you today. It doesn't matter whether I'm the DEA administrator, a Penn State mom, or for those of you out there, whether you are parents at all. We're part of the American family as grandparents and aunts and uncles and the whole entire fabric of this country that is affected very directly every single day by drugs. And it is it's a tough thing to think about, but the 3,000-plus people that we lost in the attacks on September 11th, 2001, were 3,000-plus precious souls. But contrast that every year with the people we lose to drug abuse, and that's 30,000 every year. It is staggering to think about that. So let me tell you just a little bit about DEA. I know that you read in the paper about these drug busts. Sometimes DEA is involved in them. Sometimes they're state and local law enforcement alone. Sometimes they're the two of us together. But let me just tell you a very quick thing about DEA. We have a budget of about $2.5 billion. We have about 11,000 employees, and 10% of our employees are located around the world, from in the places that you heard about in the introduction today. Many people think of DEA. Half of them carry a gun. Half of that 11,000 are agents, gun-toting agents, enforcing the laws and helping international partners around the world enforce their laws. Of these agents, let me just tell you some of the things you don't often hear. You hear about the search warrants, the drug busts, the major seizures of drugs that we take down. We are focused on dismantling whole organizations from that international supply side all the way through the transit side to the smuggling side to the distribution cells. Not the individual distributor, but that whole supply chain going down to the cells in communities. And when we do that, we are always joined by other law enforcement along the way. But let me tell you some of the things you don't hear about DEA that that really make DEA part of the family that it is as an agency and an organization. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was in New Orleans for an International Association of Chiefs of Police conference. And when I was there, we had a little bit of downtime. And I went through some of the hardest hit neighborhoods in New Orleans. And what I saw were neighborhoods still not recovered, empty neighborhoods, houses. And what was really eerie was more than years later after Katrina, what was eerie was going along and seeing these homes that still had the spray paint markings on them. And you may recall from the news coverage at the time how people were going through trying to clear houses and ensure that there were not people who still need to be rescued. And DEA was part of that. I had teams of people on the ground. I was there within that first week to support them as their leader. But they were doing the tough work, and they were going house to house in these neighborhoods. And you could still see their markings because it had an X. It had DEA across the top of it, still spray-painted on these houses today. And that X, there was a number in every part of the X. And one of those numbers was hazardous materials, whether there were hazardous materials. Were there survivors? Were there animals that could pose, both needed to be rescued, plus could pose a danger to people entering? All kinds of quick data on the markings of those houses. We rescued 3,000 people in the wake of Katrina, including 90 people who were invalids and had been abandoned in a nursing home and had to be carried down 5 flights in order to rescue them. In Lima, not that long ago, there was an 8-point on the Richter scale earthquake. Our air wing was among the first to bring MREs, the ready-made meals, in to take people, to evacuate them out. and to move people around in that country. And then at home in Chicago, there was an elementary school, K through 8, actually, elementary and middle, in Chicago, in one of the toughest areas of Chicago, that was predominantly a school with parents that were single parents in a very low economic area. The school was slated to be closed. 30 people from our Chicago DEA office years ago, a couple of years ago, adopted that school. The school had no art program. They purchased and brought in art supplies. It had no after-school programs. They started an after-school basketball program. They mentored the schools, the kids in that school. They mentored them in math and reading. And what happened was extraordinary. Because of that investment of those 30 DEA employees, the school was taken off the closing list. It is a thriving school now, and has now, as a result of all that investment in the school, become a safe haven for these kids, and no doubt a shelter for them away from drugs in a neighborhood that was otherwise rife with drugs. And then let me bring it home in a real drug sense. A couple of years ago, as the meth epidemic started sweeping across this country, methamphetamine is something that you could make, and you don't even have to have done very well in chemistry here at Penn State or in your high school. You could make it in the back of a truck. You could make it in a motel room and with supplies that you could purchase from Home Depot and your local drugstore. That epidemic started sweeping the country, and methamphetamine basically is speed on steroids almost, and would keep you up for days on end, and then you'd crash, and there was a lot of violence associated with the users. But there was a little boy whose name is Romeo. He was 4 years old, and the DEA agents and our partners, our local partners, police partners, were about to conduct a search warrant on this location where meth was being made. It happened to be in a house in Colorado. And it was there wasn't a lot of light outside. They were honed in on the house, had surveillance up, and there was this little boy, Romeo. And Romeo had his Halloween costume on. His Halloween costume had on was a skeleton, and it had that kind of iridescent, you know, reflector kind of bones all over him. The officers are looking at the house, and they're about to go in, and they start reporting over the radios. I'm sure I'm not seeing what I think I'm seeing, but I would swear there is a skeleton moving. And so they couldn't see the little boy. All they could see was the reflector tape and this of bones moving around. And that was Romeo. And this is the other part of DEA and law enforcement that you don't hear about. That day was one of many tragic days for Romeo. But it was just about to be the first day of the rest of his life and a chance at life. Because Romeo had his costume on. It was a week before Halloween. He had heard that there was going to be a Halloween party at school in his pre-K class. And he was in a rural part, a rural area of Colorado. He put his Halloween costume on, and he was out there in the wee hours of the morning before dawn looking for the school bus to come down his road because he didn't want to miss his Halloween party. And he couldn't wake his mother up because she was a meth user, a meth cooker, and had crashed from her use of methamphetamine and could not be awakened for days. So little Romeo only thought about the excitement of his Halloween party and didn't want to miss it. If we had not been there, little Romeo would have been looking for that school bus every day for 7 days, no doubt with that Halloween costume on. But what happened that day was we went in, and little Romeo was taken out, given to Child Protective Services, and went into a foster home with people that showed him what real love is. So that's a different slice of DEA than you ordinarily hear about. But let me tell you about the kind of business that we're tackling. The drug business, in the United States alone, I have described us, not us in this room, of course, but Americans, as the largest single funder of terrorism in the Western Hemisphere. Because in this country, every year, $65 billion, currency changes hands every year for drugs, $65 billion. When I came into DEA a little over 4 years ago, the most that was seized in a year of this drug money was less than $500 million out of $65 billion. I asked my people, what's it going to take to hit the pocket of these traffickers in such a way that they will feel the pain, that they won't have enough money to churn it back into drug production and supply? I was told we needed to hit $3 billion every year in order to start getting to the point, that tipping point, where traffickers could no longer write off a seizure of drugs or money as simply the cost of doing business. So we immediately set about putting in goals, monetary goals, every year over the last 4 years. And this year, we hit that $3 billion. We surpassed it. We almost closed out at $3.5 billion, which was staggering from where we came from. And it was 2 years ahead of our phased-in annual goals of trying to get to just $3 billion. So that's our focus. And when you put that kind of money in context, it's just a bunch of numbers to people until you put it into context. $65 billion is more than the net worth of Oprah Winfrey, Bill Gates, and Donald Trump combined. That's a lot of money. And if drug trafficking as a business was ranked in the Fortune 500, it would be ahead. It would be number 27, I can tell you. And it would be ahead of such heavyweights as AT&T, Time Warner, and Microsoft. And if it was not my first morning with Motorola, I could tell you where it is in relationship to Motorola. I'll let you know. The focus on money is to hit them hard so that the supply can't keep coming. The other piece of it, in addition to changing our focus and trying to hit that money harder, was to be more strategic as an agency. And I'll give you just a quick example of how we dramatically changed how we did business and have had tremendous success. The supply chain for cocaine, 90% of it comes up from Colombia. For the most part, years ago or a couple of years ago, most of it was moving by go-fast boats. And they would load tonnage quantities of cocaine on go-fast boats, and they would go fast, straight up through the Caribbean and sometimes through the Caribbean and then over to Mexico and that Central American land bridge and then smuggle across the border from there. We often would hit individual loads, but if we're not taking out the organization sending the loads, they'll just keep sending more loads. You don't really gain much. So we took it one step beyond that and said we need to put all of our intelligence together, all of us across the broad community, and let's figure out where the chokehold is. Where is that little narrow point where we can hit them hard, and really disrupt their operations? And the example I used was the GoFest boats can't go where they're headed without refueling. So how many refueling stops are there? And if there are only three refueling stops along the way, that's where we need to focus on. We need to drop a curtain so they can't refuel. And then that will disrupt how they're moving drugs, and we show up at the next plan B way that they move drugs. That was a major shift in how we approached our international supply chain going after drugs. Huge success. The price of cocaine, as a measure of how we're doing, if the price is high, then it signifies that there is less cocaine out there. The price we just announced this last week in Colombia when I was there is up 40% for the longest sustained period of this entire year. Methamphetamine up 70% the price, and the purity for both dropping and continuing to drop over the past year. We've had other successes along the way. President Bush set real measures that he expected use of drugs to go down 25% in 5 years. It's not just enforcement. We are one part of a three-step approach: enforcement, education, and treatment. Any one of the three of us without the other two of us cannot succeed. And in many ways, I describe enforcement as the last ditch. We are there when all else has failed, when education, awareness, prevention doesn't take root, sometimes because there are plentiful drugs on the street, then you end up with suppliers, traffickers, and users. When treatment is not there to heal people who have turned to drugs, you often end up with people facing arrest. And many times it is through arrest that people actually get their entree into treatment. So the three of us have a symbiotic relationship. And if there are cheap and plentiful drugs on the street, there will be a tough road for education to take root. If people are in treatment, I can tell you if there are cheap and plentiful drugs, their chances of succeeding in treatment drop. And in many cases, traffickers are the kind of people that seek out people in treatment because they know those people are vulnerable, and they seek to supply those people, which, needless to say, causes them to fail in treatment. But with the president's percentages, that 25% reduction, we've had some great success, and surprising success, actually. Over that 5-year period that it took to reach that 25% benchmark, we succeeded as to 8th and 10th graders actually exceeded the 25%. 12th graders, we didn't exceed it, but overall, there was a 23% reduction in drug use among 8th, 10th, and 12th graders. Marijuana use down 25%. Meth was cut in half. Ecstasy, more than half. Steroids, down 20% in use. LSD, 74%. And cocaine, more than half. The adult side, the surveys are less accurate now because of some changes in the methodology. But if you look at our employment population, the people who get tested, and I was very pleased when I was hired by Motorola, the condition of my employment was that I pass a drug test. So that was my first great act in Motorola, was to give them a urine specimen, and I didn't hear back. I'm pretty darn sure I passed the drug test. But if you look at our employment population, that's where you find a lot of drug users. Millions of drug users, 10 million drug users out there in America who are construction workers, who are maintenance workers, who conduct repairs. They're people in factories. I mean, think about that. When you get on a plane, drug users are out there. Think about it. And you look at the urinalysis, the testing of the adult employed population, and even those figures are down, and they are strikingly down. They are at the lowest levels of drug use in almost 20 years. So we're doing great. So why aren't I unemployed? Why is DEA still around? Well, we have some major challenges, and while we've made tremendous success on that front, prescription drug abuse has now become the monster that we all face. It's in our medicine cabinet. When homes go up for sale, we've had instances where people go in as people looking at a home and they raid the medicine cabinet of the owner, of the absent owner. We have had, you have kids who have farming parties, that would not be an F farming, but PH farming parties, where they raid their parents and family medicine chests and put drugs in the middle of a table, and that's their source of recreation. They don't even know what they're taking. The abuse of prescription drugs, I can tell you, is approaching epidemic proportions, and it is deadly. I have met with so many families, some of them high school, with kids in high school, some of them with kids in college, and their kids have died because they ordered prescription drugs off the internet. They had sites bookmarked that they didn't realize were in Mexico, for example, and the drugs were delivered to their doorstep. If you get on the internet with your kids, they are spammed constantly with ads for prescription drugs without a prescription, Vicodin without a prescription. And why did I mention Vicodin? Well, let me just give you just some of the quick data on prescription drug abuse and where we are with that. It is alarming that we have, in just 5 years, a two-thirds increase in prescription drug abuse, from about just under 4 million people to about 7 million in 5 years. We don't have to look too far to see that the abuse of prescription drugs, and I'm talking about pain relievers, opioids, serious surgery, pain relievers afterwards, Percocet, OxyContin, oxycodone, those kinds of pain relievers. That's what kids and that's what people are abusing. And in this case, this was what really got me. When you look at the new drug users, the people who abuse prescription drugs out there have overtaken the number of people who are using marijuana for the first time. Think about that. These painkillers cause more drug overdose deaths than cocaine and heroin combined. There are other staggering stats. The 7 million that I told you about in prescription drug abusers, you could add together just the abusers, not the ones who have died, the abusers. Those 7 million, you could add together all the users of cocaine, all the users of heroin, ecstasy, hallucinogens, and inhalants. Add them all together, and prescription drug abusers still outpace them. The scary thing for those of you who have loved ones in high school, you could line up 10 high school seniors, and one out of those 10 would admit to abusing prescription drugs. Their drug of choice, Vicodin. Vicodin is hydrocodone. Vicodin is a trade name. Hydrocodone is the drug name. Let's look at our prescriptions in the United States. What do you think is the number one most prescribed drug in the United States? Number one. I'm talking about legitimate drugs. Okay, well, for some of us, we might say Lipitor. For some of us. Hydrocodone, which is Vicodin, Lortab, that opioid pain reliever that the high school seniors would admit to abusing, hydrocodone outdistances Lipitor by double. Hydrocodone is the number one most prescribed drug in the United States at about 130 million prescriptions a year. Lipitor is the number two most prescribed drug in the United States, and it's at about 60 million. So, tough figures out there. And then you look at the United States against the world. We have 4% of the population of the world, yet we consume 99% of all of the world's supply of hydrocodone. So These are scary things. And why? Why? Well, some of these surveys, you don't have to look too far to figure out why. When parents and children alike, think that it's not so bad abusing painkillers because that's safer than street drugs, there's something wrong with the psyche. There's something wrong with how we look at any drug, legitimate or illegitimate, that causes us to tune out and to be numb to the rest of the world around us. And now I want to bring it home. I hope I've got five more minutes. Now I want to bring it home to us in this room, as faculty, as staff, as alums, as parents, as students, and as members of Greek organizations. When you look at some of the studies that have been put out there on prescription drug abuse, and you look at what people say is the number one issue in combating prescription drug abuse in college and university campuses, the number one reason, or the most prevalent, is because it's viewed as a normal rite of passage. And you throw alcohol in there, and you take these opioid painkillers, and then you put on alcohol abuse and binge drinking and put those two together, and it is one of the most deadly combinations there is. And why do I raise alcohol? DEA does not go after alcohol. Those are other parts of the government. But these same studies focus on alcohol and campuses, and I know Penn State has focused on it. And it is something that is an alarming issue for all colleges and universities when you look at the scary data on that. It is breathtaking when you see data coming out of Columbia University from their Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse that 49% of full-time college students binge drink and or abuse prescription or illegal drugs. Half. Think about half of the kids at Penn State living their life that way. That is an issue. It's a public health issue, but it's even more than a public health issue for a university. It becomes an issue when you look at the fact that 40% of student attrition from colleges and universities is substance abuse and alcohol related. When you look at other information out there that almost half of, on an average campus of 30,000 students, almost a third meet the criteria for substance abuse disorders, but only 4% seek help. So these are scary numbers. But what's really happening out there is that we have a culture that has been created because we think it's a rite of passage for our kids to drink. Because it's accepted to drink, and you mix with that the abuse of prescription drugs and other substances, and our kids are dying out there. I'm sorry that you're hearing from me instead of probably the most profound speaker. And those are some of the parents who've lost kids, who were on the path to becoming a pharmacist, who were on the path to doing great things, and who died because of the rite of passage. When you look at these issues, I think we have to take it on. We have to accept these kinds of issues and make it our call to action. And I was telling my husband on the way up here, I've got a huge learning curve in my my new world as of today. But as a parent of teenagers, as a Penn State parent, and as the former administrator of DEA, but I would put that in a footnote, it is our obligation to serve our country as parents, as members of this community, to try to put a stop to this. And I want to share with you the quote of the head of the Center for addiction and substance abuse at Columbia. And this is tough language, and it is especially tough language with you as my audience, but I want to share this with you. First of all, he starts before the quote, he says, you know, this is not just a human health issue, public health issue. This places universities at risk for damaging their academic reputations. When you have a 40% attrition rate at universities, then that affects your academic standing among universities. And it also is a risk because of liability for millions of dollars in lawsuits. And then this is what Joseph Califano said, who you all know as a former Secretary of Education in a prior administration. And I'm quoting him. He runs the center at Columbia University. Quote, college presidents, deans, and trustees have facilitated a college culture of alcohol and drug abuse that is linked to poor student academic performance, depression, anxiety, suicide, property damage, vandalism, fights, and a host of medical problems. By failing to become part of the solution, these Pontius Pilate presidents and parents, deans, trustees, and alumni have become part of the problem. Their acceptance of a status quo of rampant alcohol and other drug abuse puts the best and the brightest and the nation's future in harm's way. So I would leave that very tough language from Joseph Califano, who studies this as his living. I would leave that tough language with you as a call to action. There are very few universities that can boast of the unheralded firsts that Penn State can. We have an extraordinary rich history at this university of breakthroughs in science and technology and the brightest accomplishments that have given back to our country. If there is any university out there that can take this on and make this the model to all colleges and universities, it's Penn State. And I'd put my money on that one. So with that, I don't know what the way forward is, but I know from Amber Craig, who's been just a wonderful touchstone for me and the head of student affairs here at Penn State, I know from Amber that there's been a grant obtained from a federal grant obtained to start down this road. And Penn State, not surprisingly, has started down this road. But it's urgent, and it can't be left to just a grant. It really takes all of us in this room, as faculty, as staff, as alums, as Greek organizations, athletic organizations, as parents and students, to take this on. Because even though I'm standing in front of you as the administrator of DEA 12 hours ago, I did not know that binge drinking was an art form. I thought when I saw binge drinking on the news because some college student had died of alcohol poisoning from binge drinking, that was from some single event. No, it is now what people do on our college campuses. They drink to get drunk. They drink to binge drink. And that is a substantial number of our college kids. And it's true on this campus as well. So it is urgent that we take this on and that we do what Penn State is the best at doing, and that is setting an example for all colleges and universities and for America. So with that, let's find a way together. And thank you so very much for letting me end my career at DEA 12 hours ago by sharing this time with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I will apologize in advance. We have quite a few questions. I'm sure we're not going to get through all of them. But so if you don't hear yours, I apologize. Over the upcoming Thanksgiving weekend, Amsterdam will be hosting the 20th anniversary Cannabis Cup, which is apparently similar to a wine tasting if the wine were smoked. Do you think recreational drug use is more acceptable in other countries, or is this just Amsterdam being Amsterdam?
And I'll try to answer these questions very quickly. I have been in Amsterdam a number of times in my official capacity. I've met with members of parliament, and if you look at the studies out there, Amsterdam was a great experiment of coffee houses that served marijuana instead of coffee and became kind of the magnet. And then what happened was they discovered that they were not a tourism magnet, they were a marijuana tourism magnet. Then they found that marijuana was being grown locally where it had not been. They called them plantations of marijuana. In the last couple of years, they've been reducing those number of coffee houses. Many of the communities have passed laws eliminating them, and Parliament has undertaken to re-examine their legalizing the use of marijuana in coffee houses altogether. And their public health minister also noted that it not only brought the ills of traffickers in and marijuana users as their main tourism, but they noticed that their kids in schools now were skyrocketing in their use of marijuana, which did not bode well for their studies.
Well, this is a related question. Wouldn't decriminalization of marijuana help the DEA and other law enforcement agencies concentrate their efforts on major trafficking of harder drugs that support terrorism?
It's very hard to find drug trafficking organizations that aren't also trafficking in marijuana. It is a cash cow for them. So they don't just traffic in one drug. Marijuana is part of their supply chain. But equally importantly, maybe more importantly, our kids, the number one drug that our kids are seeking treatment for in America today is for marijuana dependency. So the marijuana of today is not like the marijuana in the era of Vietnam. In that era, it was 1% potent. Today, it's upwards 8, 10, 15% potent. And our kids are becoming dependent on marijuana in an addictive way.
How can the DEA actually be effective with a budget that is smaller than Penn State's?
Well, it shows you our budget, what we can do. We make it stretch really far. But when I talk to you about how much money we seize, we actually, as you may have noted, seized more money, more drug money, than our actual annual budget. I think we're the only agency that took in more money than we cost. So it's tough. But I'll tell you, probably the best way that we stretch our budget is by partnering with state and local law enforcement and our international law enforcement partners. So they are our full force multipliers, especially on our task forces.
When money assets are seized at a drug bust, where does the money go?
Great question. Where does the money go? It goes back into, in some instances, it goes back into the general treasury and gets used for government expenses. In other instances, depending on the laws, the state laws, it goes right back into state and local law enforcement. A good percentage of it goes back into that. They can't use it to hire people. They can't use it to pay salaries because you don't know from year to year how much money will come back in from seizures. But they can use it for the purchase of equipment like radios and vehicles, drug dogs, bomb dogs, all kinds of supporting expenses. So I'd say the lion's share of it goes in that direction. Some of the money goes back in to support demand reduction and other kinds of programs, anti-drug programs.
With experience in both drug enforcement and parenting, what do you think of the remarks last week by a judge who criticized the parenting skills of the Eagles football coach whose two adult sons were sentenced to jail for drug use?
You know, I don't want to comment on a specific case, but I would say that you can be really great parents and grandparents, and you can teach your kids values, and you pray that that upbringing takes hold. But you never know. And I don't know about the specific coach, and I don't want to comment on his situation, but I think it is not just the parenting. It is the societal attitude that is as much as at play in drug use and non-drug use. If there is a society that glamorizes drug use, that turns the head and says it's a rite of passage, we all are part of the problem.
To do its work, does DEA depend on outside helpers such as bounty hunters and Blackwater-type organizations?
The work of DEA is done in partnership with law enforcement, and I mean sworn law enforcement, state, local, other federal agencies. And Blackwater comes into play only in a couple of narrow instances, and I'm using Blackwater as an example. They provide diplomatic security under contract through the State Department when I am traveling internationally in certain countries like Afghanistan. But it is only security for an official like me limited to the time of that travel. The other area is they have provided some training for our protection detail. Other than that, the arrest of all of the defendants in DEA's cases are arrests that are made by sworn law enforcement officials, DEA, and other partners.
Your statistics suggest that hydrocodone is overprescribed in this country. Is the DEA doing anything within the medical community to limit or diminish this overprescription?
That's a great question. When I came into DEA 4+ years ago, there was a doctor in upstate New York, a treatment doctor, who wrote into DEA, actually even before that point, and said, you got to look at hydrocodone because I'm treating people, and this is becoming a crisis with a number of people coming in addicted and abusing hydrocodone. DEA has a system that we go through when we get those kinds of alarms where we analyze the abuse pattern, which we did. And then we submit it to the Food and Drug Administration at Health and Human Services. And the Food and Drug Administration, under law, has their review of the issue, and that has been with the Food and Drug Administration now for years, and we are still waiting on them to complete their process. After that, then DEA it comes back to DEA, and we can determine whether to raise hydrocodone in a higher schedule on the drug chart. When we do that, once we can get to that point, if we do that, that will be a significant benefit, because what is happening is over the internet, you don't need a prescription for hydrocodone by these rogue pharmacies. Hydrocodone is flooding everywhere. If it's moved up into a higher schedule, what would happen is you can't get hydrocodone without a paper prescription. It can't just be over the phone. You have to present a paper prescription in order to get that filled. And that would be a significant advantage in curtailing the abuse.
The DEA recently exposed a ring of steroids supplied by China. How prevalent is the use and abuse of steroids, and what, if any, was the DEA's role in the Balco doping scandal?
There were a number of agencies involved in the Balco investigation. DEA was one of those agencies, along with IRS and others. And we have a number of steroid investigations, some major successes on that front. And as I mentioned to you, steroid abuse by our young people is down, our teenagers is down about 20%. Steroids is a huge problem. And it is a physical disaster to the human body that people, and certainly our kids, have no clue. in girls, it causes them to become more male-like in all matters. For boys, it causes them to lose their male features in a number of ways. And worse, the aggression, I mean, you've heard about Chris Benoit, the wrestler who killed his wife and son, and other people abusing steroids. The aggression that comes from that is substantial. So steroids are a very big issue for us beyond just fair play in sports.
Students use and abuse Red Bull and similar energy drinks. Should DEA be involved?
Well, as I said, DEA doesn't do alcohol. We don't really do beverages. Let me just go to Red Bull for a minute. We have a teenager who drinks Red Bull all the time. And I didn't really think much about it until I was in a foreign country and someone told me in that country that their kids use Red Bull as the drink into which you pour alcohol. So it's the starter. And that certainly, as a mother, got my attention. I'm not suggesting that Red Bull is always combined with alcohol. But I think that is something for parents and people to be aware of and to be cautious about. I'm sure Red Bull is a wonderful drink. I have not had it. I have a different source of caffeine. So I don't want to talk about Red Bull because it's a commercial product that many people like. Let me just say on a different level, drinks and other things that are used in combination with alcohol that are consumed by our kids is something we just need to be aware of.
Is the DEA doing anything in collaboration with the NCAA and or professional sports to prevent the abuse or use of steroids in collegiate and professional sports?
Yes, I was approached by all of the professional leagues, baseball, football, hockey, basketball, and some other related entities about trying to partner more closely on issues of illegal drugs, steroids among them. And we have been trying to work together to find ways where we can partner more closely. And I think we've found some minimal ways. Frankly, it's been tough with players' unions and contract provisions. It's been tough for them to partner with us in law enforcement in a way we really need the most, and that is giving us access to players that are involved in drugs that they find out about during the course of their profession.
How do you respond to environmentalists who argue that hemp produced from marijuana plants is a safer alternative to the petrochemicals we now use in plastics, paper, cellophane, and other products?
Hemp is something that is continuing to go through a court process, so I don't want to speak about hemp in depth, but let me just say that hemp is grown as marijuana. It's not a hemp plant, it's a marijuana plant. And in order for hemp products to be derived from that, you need to, obviously there are issues with security and control of the cultivation of the plant so that it doesn't get diverted for smoking. And those are things that we've addressed. There are regulations that were put in place that permitted hemp products to be sold in the United States as long as they were products that you couldn't consume. So rope, clothing, checkbook covers. I think the Department of Justice checkbook cover, I noticed, was made from hemp. Imagine. There are all kinds of products that are non-consumables that are permitted, but there have been some court challenges, and those are still, I believe, working their way through the system.
Do you have any plans to write a book about your experience at the helm of the DEA?
Let me just say this. It was a wonderful, incredible 4-plus years. I pinched myself regularly when I met with prime ministers and presidents and dealt with the most significant issues facing our kids, our country, And there were some fun experiences along the way and some terrifying ones an assassination threat. But I don't plan to write a book. I'm one of those people that just keeps moving forward. And for me, I have a great opportunity with Motorola, and I am looking forward to this learning curve and the excitement of being in corporate America and contributing to a company that is a tremendous good citizen in this country and is a real partner with law enforcement.
What compelled you to switch careers from public service to the corporate world?
Well, in about 13 months, I was about to turn into a pumpkin. And as a appointee of President Bush's and with the outgoing administration, I serve at the pleasure of the president. And so, therefore, when the president left, I, too, would have been leaving. And it was the right time for me when Motorola approached me to make that step forward in my next life.
As the first woman to head the DEA, did you ever find your gender to be either an asset or drawback?
You know, that was the most frequent question I was asked, particularly because it's a law enforcement agency, because most of the agency, a good percentage of the agency, are gun-toting males. And the question is not surprisingly posed, what is it like to be the first woman at the head of a male-dominated gun-toting agency? And I have to say, my gender just was irrelevant. What the people of the Drug Enforcement Administration wanted and what they cared about was good leadership. And they really, frankly, didn't care what gender delivered it to them. So that was my experience.
We have time for just one more question, but first I'm going to join you on the podium.
Thank you.
On behalf of the Faculty Staff Club and the Penn State Forum, I would like to present you with this plaque, along with our deepest appreciation for joining us here today, for sharing your behind-the-scenes stories of the DEA, and for being such an inspiration. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And every Penn State mom needs to have a Penn State mug, so we'd like you to have this Penn State Forum mug. It is definitely not a cannabis cup. Rest assured.
Thank you very much.
And one final question.
This was, I was told, supposed to be the fun question.
Yes. 1 year ago this month, Nevada voters turned down a ballot measure that would have legalized marijuana. Do you think they feared that a yes vote would send the wrong message to Nevada's young gamblers and prostitutes?
I am speechless. I don't know about what was in the mind of the voters of Nevada. You said they turned it down? God bless the voters of Nevada. I do know that when the marijuana legalizers, come to town in trying to put these ballot initiatives before the voters, they often, as was the case in neighboring Colorado, they often put together billboards that tout this ballot initiative, whatever it is, the number of it, and talk about a safer community and never once mentioned the word marijuana, so that people end up voting for something that's safer for the community without even knowing that they're voting to legalize marijuana. I don't know if that's what happened in Nevada, but these legalizers come into a state, and it is not a grassroots movement within a state to legalize marijuana by the people in that state. These are legalizers that go around the country that are well-funded, trying to legalize marijuana, and they move in and put these ballot initiatives together and try to sell them. I think that marijuana is something that we all need to be very, very careful about when you look at the studies. But go on the DEA website and look at all the sourced information, not DEA saying it, but sourced. You have to stop and think. When the American Medical Association votes and does not adopt marijuana as medicine. You got to stop and think. When the American Psychiatric Association talks about the dangers of marijuana, you have to stop and think. When the associations for glaucoma and MS say that it does not, marijuana is not medicine for those conditions, and these are the associations, professional associations for those diseases, you have to stop and think. But you really don't have to get much farther than knowing that America's kids who are in treatment for drug dependency are in treatment for dependency for marijuana above all other drugs, including alcohol. Those are our kids. That is our future. So with that, let me just say that when I was preparing for today, I pulled out a clip from the Collegian, and right here on the campus of Penn State, a letter to the editor, I believe it's October 6th, 2006. And the letter was from a student here who said, basically, the answer to dealing with binge drinking is to legalize marijuana. So, don't think it's just Nevada. Thank you.